chapche tupa tang sanpa tang gombe kirab gongi gongdo berde ta ye pe shimje nang la penpa jachembo rupto par chuchi.
Good evening to you all. I wish you tashi delek. I hope that for all of you everything is filled with auspiciousness, happiness, and excellence. And along with that, I pray that your wisdom arising from listening to, reflecting on, and meditating on the teachings of the genuine Dharma will increase and increase, and that through this you will be able to be of great benefit to all of the limitless number of sentient beings. Please begin by singing the song sung by the Lord of Yogis Milarepa called the Song of the Profound Definitive Meaning, sung on the snowy range. Supreme Guru, I bow down at your feet. The cities of blessings come straight from the Takinis. Samaya's nectar is the most nourishing drink. Your offering of faith has kept me so healthy. Before listening to the teachings, please give rise to the supreme motivation of bodhicitta, which means that for the benefit of all sentient beings who are as limitless in number as the sky is vast in its extent, we aim to bring our compassion and love to their ultimate perfection and our wisdom realizing the true nature of reality to its ultimate perfection. In other words, we aim to attain the state of complete and perfect Buddhahood. And we know that in order to do this, we must listen to, reflect on, and meditate on the teachings of the genuine Dharma with all of the enthusiasm we can muster in our hearts. This is the supreme motivation of bodhicitta. Please give rise to it and listen.
Nyeba la nendur chun dor temba da jeper cheba nile tambun dor temba namba chu neyong chur neyong chur par jo bani la namba ba ni de ngo de da ka za da chebar go ba ne da ne yile se da jo wa da nime peyong jo pe so chi za zo.
We're on page 123, the expanded explanation of the distinctive features of transformation. This section has two parts. First is the brief presentation of the 10 headings that make up the 10 topics here, and then the expansion on these 10, the explanation of each one individually. So the brief presentation of the headings has root text that reads, is there anyone who still doesn't have the book who's writing down the verses? Okay. This 10-point presentation of transformation provides an unsurpassable introduction. Because it is the way to approach the essence, the ingredients and individuals, the special traits, requirements, and ground, mental cultivation and application, the disadvantages and benefits. This 10-point presentation of transformation provides an unsurpassable introduction because it is the way to approach the essence, the ingredients and individuals, the special traits, requirements and ground, mental cultivation and application, the disadvantages and benefits. The commentary reads, this 10-point presentation, enabling knowledge as well as accomplishment of thorough transformation, provides an unsurpassable introduction because it is the way one comprehends what is actually meant by thorough transformation and puts it into practice, thereby attaining the ultimate among results. This is an explanation from the perspective of affirmation as opposed to negation. So it's not an explanation that negates what genuine reality is not. It is a positive explanation of what genuine reality and the transformation that accomplishes it is. And the reason why it is unsurpassable, this explanation, is that by understanding it, you can put it into practice and then you can realize it. So that's the purpose of receiving this explanation, is to be able to put it into practice so that you can achieve what it's talking about. To name the 10 which make up this approach, they include the essence, or the nature of the transformation, that's the first, its ingredients or contents, meaning when transformation occurs, what is transforming and how. That's the second point. Then third, the individuals who are transformed. Fourth, its mental cultivation the individuals who are transformed, I skipped a line. And its special traits and requirements, and what constitutes its ground or support, its mental cultivation and application, as well as the disadvantages that would follow if there were no such thing as this transformation. In other words, what are the logical flaws in the belief that transformation doesn't exist, and what are the benefits that follow because there is transformation? How is it that transformation can be established if you analyze to be what actually happens when someone attains realization? Together, this 10-point presentation of transformation provides an unsurpassable
because it is the way to approach the essence, the ingredients and individuals, the special traits, requirements and ground, mental cultivation and application, the disadvantages and benefits.
Nyeba jike la dorten je rimba tan tsungbar jike chule tambo ngone jone tela ngorun jokwa ne lorwa ye trima tan te ye nyeme nawa tan nawa tondo te ye nye trima me ba kanyi ba wo.
And there is the expanded explanation describing each of these 10 points individually. First, the essence. And here the root text reads, the essence of transformation is introduced as suchness freed of stain. And what that means is superficial stains appear no longer, and that which manifests is now the suchness. The essence of transformation is introduced as suchness freed of stain. And what that means is superficial stains appear no longer, and that which manifests is now the suchness.
Tela rangi nenjuram ngo nenjurwani ngorjupani ngo nenjurwani.
The essence, i.e. the makeup of transformation, is introduced as consisting of the suchness, pure being, freed of superficial stain. That means superficial stains appear no longer, and suchness manifests. That is to say, pure being, which is free of stain in its very essence, manifests just as it is.
Teya lor je teme, lor churpa teme drepa kapso, chuyen te yenye tonta bedenba manawata. Lor churpa tramatan travetse, chuyenye te yenye ngondo chorte nenjewa.
When it is covered by superficial stains, then pure being, the true nature of reality, does not appear. But when one clears away these obscurations, then it manifests, and that's what transformation is all about. You go from not realizing suchness to realizing it. The essence of transformation is introduced as suchness freed of stain, and what that means is superficial stains appear no longer, and that which manifests is now the suchness.
Nyaman tinglin tunwa sir ji ya seba chonyo batang yendo lorun chup chamal le trote chunyan chuyen
In short, it's like when the sun appears in a sky that used to be filled with clouds, but now the clouds are gone. Or when gold is refined so that all of the impure metals in the gold ore are no longer present and there's just pure gold. Or when water that once was muddy is now clear because the mud has settled down out of the water. In this way, pure being or Dharma Dhatu, the expanse of qualities, when transformation occurs, appears perfectly without any obscuration in between oneself and the realization, the experience of that. Then the second main point is the ingredients of transformation, what it is that transforms and how. And here the root verses read, to introduce the ingredients or contents, awareness in the form of the vessel shared undergoes a transformation to suchness. The sutras undergo a transformation into the suchness, the actual Dharma Dhatu. And beings with an apostrophe after the S, beings' awareness components not shared in common undergo a transformation to suchness, to introduce the ingredients or contents, awareness in the form of the vessel shared, undergoes a transformation to suchness. The sutras undergo a transformation into the suchness, the actual Dharma Dhatu, and beings' awareness components not shared in common undergo a transformation to suchness. To introduce the ingredients, that is, the contents of this complete transformation, this subject is here summarized under 3 points. First, image awareness, meaning that which appears in the form of the world of the vessel, which is seemingly shared in common. Seemingly is an important word here because there really is no such thing as a common appearance, an objective appearance. There is only subjective appearance when you really analyze, because appearances are just the projections of one's own habitual tendencies. So they're mind only. It seems like everybody perceives the same thing. However, and this seemingly common appearance of the world undergoes a complete transformation to suchness when there's realization of its true nature. Then second, the signifiers appearing in the form of the letters, terms, and statements of the sutra texts and the Dharma Dhatu they teach undergo a complete transformation into the suchness, which is the actual Dharma Dhatu. So first we had the physical environment, and now we have words, terms, letters in both spoken and written form, and these transform into the Dharma Dhatu of the sutras. They appear when they are perceived as teachings. Every sound is a teaching. Because one realizes its true nature, which is Dharma Dhatu. And then third and finally, and the principles of awareness consisting of conscious mind and mental states, which are the components of beings that comprise their individual mind streams and are not shared in common, also undergo a transformation to suchness. So this refers to conventionally, what conventionally is your own mind. So your own mind is something which, even in relative reality, is not a common experience. It's your own individual experience. And this too, when you have realization, transforms into suchness. And the commentary continues, since no phenomenon of any sort whatsoever exists that is not included within the Dharma Dhatu, since all phenomena are pervaded by Dharma Dhatu, the expanse of qualities that is the true nature of reality, the transformed qualities present within the untainted expanse, within Dharma Dhatu, when transformation has been undergone, are inconceivable in number, covering in their extent the entire phenomenal world in all its aspects. Here, however, they are presented in terms of the following three. So the qualities of transformation are inconceivable, but you can summarize them into these three that were presented before and now will just be expanded upon. First, the transformation of the vessel, and by the force of that, everything appearing as bodies of sentient beings. This is the attainment of Dharmakaya, the omnipresent suchness, in which there is neither a center nor outer boundaries. So the transformation of the physical world corresponds to the attainment of the Dharmakaya, beyond center and end. Then second, the transformation of everything included under the process of speech, as exemplified by the sutras. This is the attainment of Sambhogakaya, the mastery of the melodious sound of Dharma in an uninterrupted flow, and of qualities knowing no end. Qualities of speech, enlightened speech, that are inexhaustible. And third, the transformation of that which comprises mind, namely the all-inclusive base, the base consciousness, and the sevenfold collection supported by it. This refers to the eight consciousnesses. This is the attainment of Nirmanakaya, whose field of experience consists of the five forms of wisdom. So the eight consciousnesses transform into the five wisdoms, and that corresponds to the attainment of the supreme Nirmanakaya, who possesses these five wisdoms.
Yangna Rinpa Yin, Khetur Jinda, Yangna Rinpa Yin, Sen Nu Jin Jikti Nen Jirvi, Jangka Nambar Tapata. Nangju Ji Sim Jin Nam Nen Jirvi, Lu Yonso Tapata.
Alternatively, another explanation would be to say that the specific features of these three transformations should be viewed in respective order as consisting first of the appearances comprising completely pure domains and bodies. So that means that the outer world transforms into pure realms, and all of the sentient beings who inhabit the world transform into pure appearances themselves, meaning of bodhisattvas and bodhisattvas. Then the imparting of genuine Dharma instruction, so speech transforms into Dharma teaching. And finally, the revelation of all aspects of knowledge through the wisdom of simplicity and that of complexity. So wisdom in general is said to have two different aspects. First is the aspect that knows simplicity, meaning that knows genuine reality. And then the aspect that knows complexity is the aspect of wisdom that knows everything in the relative. However many things there are, wisdom is aware of their qualities. And so that's the wisdom that knows complexity. These two are undifferentiable in essence. They are just different aspects of what wisdom knows and how it knows it.
Tela zukintam yebdan katok namba zukintam nga dardeba nava namhi di yordo churba nga dardeba.
Furthermore, in the context where the transformation has not been undergone, anything possessing form, meaning shape and color, and any sound characterized as speech qualify as appearances shared in common, whereas mind is not experienced in common. So that's how it appears in conventional reality. Forms and sounds appear to be common appearances, mind not. But when the transformation has been undergone, all phenomena are nothing other than manifestations of the suchness, and there is no impurity involved. So this distinction disappears. For that reason, they are appearances demonstrating the specific feature of being exclusively pure self-manifestation. So self-manifestation, if you look in the footnote, it explains that this term, self-manifestation, means non-dualistic appearance. So that's what the enlightened mind knows. It knows things in a non-dualistic way. And therefore, there's no distinction anymore between something being a unique experience to one sentient being and common experiences to everyone else. That distinction just dissolves. Nevertheless, in the eyes of those who have not undergone transformation, so still, even though the Buddhas perceive things in this way, in a non-dualistic way, for everybody else who's left, the one who has achieved that transformation will be experienced in a fashion involving differentiation, where he is seen as being a teacher distinct from his teaching, and so on.
Undergoes a formation to suchness. The sutras undergo a transformation into the suchness, the actual Dharma Dhatu, and beings awareness components not shared in common undergo a transformation to suchness.
Ya, tahu tu pun dah naik ya, cerita tu cabang tu. Cabang tu mana kegiatan?
So we're going to stop here for tonight. What are your questions? If you have any, please ask.
You taught last night how bodhisattvas eliminate the perception of characteristics on the 10 bhumis. Please explain how this is different from a blank emptiness or nihilism. Also, how does a Buddha or high-level bodhisattva distinguish pure appearances if they have no identifying characteristics? And how is a Buddha able to know the world of conventional phenomena as we perceive them when he does not perceive characteristics as we do? And it's difficult to know right now exactly what a pure appearance is.
Kongi kaji ni ishu gido.
Yeah.
Tambo tsenzin sa gyepa ne pangido.
Ore.
Dene tsenma madzina.
Meo, dene jo san.
Dene tsenzin mepe ninang de kandido?
Ninang de nisun nang za ma to dene meo, dene jo sene mingda dede menzin bari.
Nasa. Rangzhen Dabo.
Rangzhen Dabo Mzimba.
No, sir. So just to go over what these three kinds of obscurations are, so we have a clear picture in the first place. The first is called clinging to things as being truly existent. So all sentient beings have that, and that's something that you eliminate when you reach the first bodhisattva ground, become a noble bodhisattva, and then you are in a state where you're experiencing things. The example is like in a dream when you know you're dreaming. So you perceive things and their characteristics, but you don't take them to be truly existent. So at that point, you don't have any clinging to things as being real, but you do still have clinging to characteristics, because like you see fire and you think it's fire. He thinks you see water and you think it's water like that. But then on the eighth bodhisattva ground, you even give up this clinging to characteristics, and you have what's left is just called mere dualistic appearance. So it's hard to understand what that's like, because it's the most subtle level of clinging that we have. And it's something like you just perceive mere appearances without naming them at all. But that doesn't mean that you're going into some like blank state of nihilism, because at the same time, your non-conceptual wisdom is growing. And so non-conceptual wisdom knows everything, but in a non-dualistic way, in a non-conceptual way. So that's why there's no nihilism.
Another
way you can think about it is that, in terms of examples for what these three obscurations are like, is that clinging to things as being truly existent is like when you dream and you don't know you're dreaming. Then just having clinging to characteristics is like dreaming and knowing that you're dreaming. And then just having dualistic appearance is like dreaming that you dreaming and you know you're dreaming, and then you just let your mind relax into its own basic nature. And then you don't have any clinging to characteristics even. Clinging to characteristics self-liberates.
And
the way that this would be explained according to Mahamudra is that when you realize Mahamudra, that is the true nature of mind, luminous clarity, then you realize that all thoughts that cling to things as being real and all thoughts that cling to characteristics are just the play of Mahamudra itself. And so they are self-arisen and self-liberated. They are like waves coming up and then falling back into the ocean. Dene Diwachik Kasang Rinpoche Gi Negyur Tartuk Be Kapsu Sanjay Gi Gopang To Be Kapsu Dene Danang Shinkam Tang Ku Tayepa Shargito Yeneyang
Rinpoche Nato La Gagando Serge Sayeta Rinpoche Nato Ke Jemba La Soba Hiki Te Kunzup Ji Hiki
Nasa. And the second question is about the explanation that when you achieve perfect transformation and attain enlightenment, then you experience limitless pure appearances of pure realms and enlightened forms. And if there's not even any dualistic appearances left, then what do these pure realms and pure forms look like? And the answer to this question is that this is just an explanation given in harmony with the concepts of people who like the idea of seeing pure realms and enlightened forms. Because actually, what the Buddha knows and how the Buddhas know it is inconceivable to ordinary sentient beings. So you just put the best face on it. You just describe it in the best possible way that people will like. And so people like the idea of gold and silver and gems, and so they say these pure realms are made out of gold and silver and everybody looks fantastic because this is what people like to hear. So it sounds good. It's just a conventional explanation. It's like that. Any other questions?
I was curious about Rinpoche's use of the phrase immersion into the core last night and wondered if that happens naturally as a result of the process of habituation through the path of meditation or if something else has to occur.
Like what?
That's my question. Is it just through habituation alone or is there something more that happens in that final step?
Rinpa Tama Nyewar Songpa Ngola Mola Nyewar Songpa.
Nyewar Songpa. Ore.
Rela.
Rela. Nyewar Songpa.
Rela. Tene. Nyewar Songpa de. Komba de la tene. Rangshin gi ngundu gyurgidu. Yana shenda chikogidu.
Yenda gogumudo komba thar senpa la tende. Tene ngundu churpare. Drama sepa kapsu ngundu churpare.
Naso. First of all, this term, immersion into the core. Another way you could describe it, a synonym for it would be to say manifestation or actualization. So what that means is that it's just a process of clearing away the stains so that what's present all along now manifests perfectly. It's not the case that you are getting something that you didn't have before. Because what we're talking about realizing is just the true nature of your own mind, what your own mind actually is, its basic nature, its Dharma Dhatu, right? The true nature of it being this expanse of enlightened qualities, Dharma Dhatu from the beginning. This is something that happens as a result of the natural, like you described it, is the natural result of cultivating awareness of it on the path of meditation. There's nothing else you need besides that. Because this path of, this last path is called the path of no more training. It's reached as the natural result of perfecting your training, of perfecting your habituation to your realization. And it's something that can really be only described by means of these physical examples of like space being free of clouds, of gold ore being purified of all impure substances, and of water being freed of mud and now being clear. Because apart from these examples, it's very difficult to describe what it is in speech or just with abstract words. In the text called the Gyulama, the Treatise on Buddha Nature, there's one verse that describes the Buddha nature using these same examples. What it says is like a precious jewel, like the sky, like water. It's in its essence, it has always been free of the mental afflictions. And the Buddha taught about this purity in the second turning of the wheel of Dharma too, in the Prajnaparamita Sutras. He taught about perfect purity, taught that desire is perfectly pure, anger is perfectly pure, and stupidity is perfectly pure. And he taught that the self and the 12 different ways of saying self, of expressing self, are all completely pure. And he taught about this perfect purity and complete purity in connection with all of the phenomena from form through omniscience. And this is called the set of 108, the 108 different phenomena that comprise samsara and nirvana. Taught about them all being perfectly pure, all being completely pure. And the reason why is that is understandable when you think about it in these stages. First stage is when you cling to forms and other things as being truly existent, because you don't analyze their true nature to find out if they really exist or not. So that's called the stage of no analysis. At that stage, everything seems to be real. But then at the second stage, which is called the stage of slight analysis, then you just analyze a little bit and you find out that what you thought was real doesn't exist at all. And you get this image of reality being like space, just pure space, being emptiness, because you can't find anything that really exists. So you conclude that nothing really exists. That's called the stage of slight analysis. Then the third stage is the stage of thorough analysis. And at that stage, you look and you see that the true nature of all of these things is beyond existence and non-existence both. It's beyond any fabrication, any concept of what it might be. And in what is beyond concept, there can be no stain. And therefore, its nature is completely pure. And in his text, which is an explanation of these teachings the Buddha gave in the middle turning of the wheel of Dharma, the fundamental wisdom of the middle way. In that text, the protector Nagarjuna writes verses like, "Samsara is not the slightest bit different from nirvana. Nirvana is not the slightest bit different from samsara. Whatever is the nature of the Tathagata, that is the nature of sentient beings. Just as the Tathagata has no inherent nature, sentient beings have no inherent nature either." These verses, we need to see, are explaining to us the meaning of complete purity, the meaning of perfect purity. Generally, when the second turning of the wheel of Dharma is taught, then it's explained that the ultimate teaching of the second turning is that the true nature of reality is beyond conceptual fabrication. It's inconceivable. And it's not usually taught that the true nature of reality is perfect purity as the ultimate teaching. But if you look at it by extension, then actually this is the ultimate teaching, because what is beyond conceptual fabrication is perfectly pure, because there's no way it can be stained. So it's perfectly pure. And in fact, in this day and age, that's the better way to describe it. That's the better way to practice it. It's the better way to understand it, is that the teaching of the second turning is that all phenomena are perfectly pure. And I think also in this modern day and age, there are more and more signs, more and more evidence that everything is completely pure. If we look at these three main topics of the chapter on perfect purity, which are desire, anger, and stupidity, then when we examine the true nature of these three, we find that their nature transcends conceptual fabrication. You can't say they exist or they don't exist, that they are something, that they are nothing. They are beyond concept in their true nature. And what is beyond concept cannot be corrupted by any stain, because it's inconceivable. And therefore, it's perfectly pure. And so desire is perfectly pure, anger is perfectly pure, and stupidity is perfectly pure. And what's more, they always have been that way. It's not the case that they were at one point impure and then they became pure. It is the case that from the very beginning, their original nature is perfect purity. And since they are perfectly pure, then all of the phenomena connected with them are also perfectly pure. And this the Buddha described in these 108, this set of 108 phenomena. They are all perfectly pure. One reason that we can use to see why desire, anger, and stupidity are perfectly pure is that they don't come from anywhere and they don't go anywhere. So it's easy to see in the beginning, if you look at your desire or anger or stupidity, you can't find where it came from. It doesn't come from anywhere. If it doesn't come from anywhere, it can't be here now. And it can't go anywhere. So it's free from coming and going. This is something the Buddha taught extensively in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, and that Nagarjuna proved with logical reasoning in his chapter called An Examination of Coming and Going.
Yang kolo parpa kapsa rikpe jiru dhubri. Chadang mung som chujin. Ngo namba taba yinde rong me basar.
It's the tradition of the second turning of the wheel of Dharma to use logical reasons to explain things. And so the way we would do that in this case would be to say, given desire, anger, and stupidity, they are in essence perfectly pure because they don't come from anywhere and they don't go anywhere. Like desire, anger, and stupidity in a dream.
Yang chadang mung som chuchin. Number zapa yindi, tangbo cheva mame. Tharang kakpa mame, u neba mame kuse. Shirab je che na mame kuse. Dise na number zapa.
You could also say, given desire, anger, and stupidity, they are in essence completely pure, perfectly pure, because in the beginning you can't see them arising. You cannot perceive them arising. In the middle you cannot perceive them abiding anywhere. And at the end you can't see them ceasing.
We
could also say desire, anger, and stupidity are perfectly pure because they're unfindable. You can't find them out in the object that you're feeling them about. You can't find them in between you and the object. And you can't find them in your body. You can look for them in your heart. You can look for them in your brain. You can't find them anywhere. They are unfindable. They are imperceptible. They are beyond conceptual fabrication. Therefore, they are completely pure. When you look for them in your body, the two main places you would look would be in your heart and your brain. But when you look in your heart and your brain, you don't see anger, desire, or stupidity. Therefore, they are unfindable. They are imperceptible. They are beyond any conceptual attempt to understand or experience them. So they're perfectly pure.
This is na chadang mon rang yenda ke chadang mon som na che to ko mar rang ke chadang mon som la sirap che tam che na yang che na tuba tam che len de ba re ma.
You can't analyze somebody else's desire, anger, or stupidity. Can only examine your own. So when you experience these things, then look for them. And when you do, you can't find them. You can't find any way to adequately describe what they are with any conceptual reference or conceptually elaborated description. So they're beyond concept.
Damn. Tene chadamon som namba taba de tseka heza mayimba pumbu ngayi tambo zogni zongde tene devin tato namba tamjen jembe yikije.
And since they're beyond concept, they are perfectly pure. And this is not something the Buddha just kind of said in passing in a few sentences and then went on his way. He taught about it extensively by connecting the perfect purity of these three with the 108 phenomena from form through omniscience. And in this way, taught about perfect purity in a vast way.
Tenyan tambo pumbo ngala jana
The first phenomenon that he connected desires perfect purity with, and all of them, in fact, but desires the first, is the aggregate of forms, the first of the five aggregates or skandhas. And so the Buddha taught desire is perfectly pure, and therefore forms are perfectly pure. Forms are perfectly pure, and therefore desire is perfectly pure. Thus, desire perfectly pure and forms perfectly pure are not dual, cannot be made dual, are not separate, and are not different. Then the aggregate of feelings. Desire is perfectly pure, and therefore feelings are perfectly pure. Feelings are perfectly pure, and therefore desire is perfectly pure. Thus, desire perfectly pure and feelings perfectly pure are not dual, cannot be made dual, are not separate, and are not different. There's too many to go through all 108 right now. So we can then connect anger's perfect purity with the perfect purity of discriminations, because the source of anger is discriminations that we make. So it's good to connect these two, and we would do so by reciting as the Buddha taught, anger is perfectly pure, and therefore discriminations are perfectly pure. Discriminations are perfectly pure, and therefore anger is perfectly pure. Thus, anger perfectly pure, and discriminations perfectly pure, are not dual, cannot be made dual, are not separate, and are not different. You'll notice that first it says anger is perfectly pure and therefore discriminations are perfectly pure. So anger's perfect purity proves that discriminations are perfectly pure. And then discriminations are perfectly pure and therefore anger is perfectly pure. So either one can prove the perfect purity of the other. It just depends on which one you understand first. If first you understand that anger is perfectly pure, that proves that discriminations are perfectly pure. Or you might first understand that discriminations are perfectly pure, and that proves that anger is perfectly pure. So they're both equally able to prove the perfect purity of the other. By understanding the perfect purity of one thing, you know the perfect purity of all. And if we connect this now with the aggregate of formations, we would say anger is perfectly pure and therefore formations are perfectly pure. Formations are perfectly pure and therefore anger is perfectly pure. Thus, anger perfectly pure and formations perfectly pure are not dual, cannot be made dual, are not separate, and are not different. And if we then looked at the last aggregate of the five, which is consciousnesses, and connected that with stupidity's perfect purity, then the verse goes, stupidity is perfectly pure, and therefore consciousnesses are perfectly pure. Consciousnesses are perfectly pure, and therefore stupidity is perfectly pure. Thus, stupidity perfectly pure, and consciousnesses perfectly pure are not dual, cannot be made dual, are not separate, and are not different. First, the verse says, stupidity is perfectly pure, and therefore, consciousnesses are perfectly pure. If you know that stupidities are perfectly pure, then how could there be any consciousness that's not perfectly pure? They're all perfectly pure too. Or, you might first realize that consciousnesses are perfectly pure. And if you know that consciousnesses are perfectly pure, stupidity has to be perfectly pure too. And so what this shows is that in fact consciousness and stupidity are in the true nature of reality equality. They're undifferentiable in both being of the nature of perfect purity. The way that these verses are transcribed in the sutras themselves is that each verse is written out completely. There's no attempt made to condense them or to cut out the repetition. So you end up with a lot of big books. But what we've done now is to put it all on one or two or three pieces of paper so that it's easy to recite the verses and just fill in the blanks with the next ones on the list. So tomorrow we'll hand these out because it makes them easy to recite. In which
sutra did the Buddha teach these verses?
Pardon me?
In which sutra did the Buddha teach?
It's called the Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Sutra. Specifically, the 100,000 verse Prajnaparamita Sutra, called the Sutra of the Great Mother.
Yeah.
And in this day and age, you can do things like press one button on your computer and send out emails to lots of different people at the same time, hundreds of people even. And you can also have one image that is broadcast on millions of television sets at the same time. So this is a very good example for complete purity and perfect purity, because the perfect purity of one proves the perfect purity of all. That one is perfectly pure shows that all are perfectly pure. And this is how the Buddha taught that since desire is perfectly pure, anger and stupidity are perfectly pure, then all the phenomena, from form up to even the Buddha's own omniscience, are all perfectly pure. So these days, we can see that people are even able to escape the bondage of gravity and build space stations in the sky. And this is also a good example for perfect purity, because it's an example that shows that things can be accomplished and that you can accomplish the omniscient wisdom of the Buddha that knows perfect purity. Then there is the list of the 12 ways of saying self, and these are all connected with the teachings on complete purity. And we also put this list of 12 on one piece of paper so that it's very easy to recite the verses about complete purity. It's like that. The verses connected with desires, perfect purity, angers, perfect purity, and stupidities, perfect purity. In each section, there are 108 verses. And I've said all over the place that if you recite these three sections of 108, 108 times each, then that would be very good.
It's a good thing to do.
The reason why it's good to recite them 108 times is if you do that, then you'll memorize them. And also, the more you recite, the more your certainty in them will increase. In earlier times, the explanation was one of the transcendence of conceptual fabrication, and perfect purity and complete purity were not explained. But now I think the time has come in this modern day and age to explain complete purity and perfect purity. Because this is a day and age when all the time we are witnessing people make things that have never been made before, do things that have never been done before. And that's why it's good to give explanations in ways that they've never been given before. And that would be to emphasize the teachings on complete purity and perfect purity. It's like that. The translator says we have 20 more minutes. So is there any other questions?
Well, my question seems logical to me. If the three poisons are pure, and the whole phenomenon is pure, why is it bad to identify with the three poisons, and also why is there suffering?
Duksum nambar dapa yina dene duksum gi dungal zoe gyumsen karre duksum la jesu droa dukcha yimbe gyumsen karre. It all depends on whether you know that they are perfectly pure or not. If you don't know they're perfectly pure, then you take them to be truly existent. And then you fall under their influence, and that causes suffering. So the easiest example, or the easiest way to understand that, is by way of the example of the dream when you don't know you're dreaming. Then, even though all the things that appear in the dream are perfectly pure, because you don't know that, they can seem to cause you suffering, like being burned in a fire or being carried away by a river of water. It's not really happening. It's all perfectly pure, actually, but if we don't recognize that, then they appear to cause us suffering. So that makes it easy to understand. But if, while you're not knowing it's a dream, and you're being burned in the fire or carried away by the water, you can then recognize it's a dream, then the fire won't burn you, the water won't carry you away. You can even then just jump into the sky and start flying in the sky. And some people can even dance in the sky. And if you're a Vajrayana practitioner, you can transform yourself into a deity and do a very nice dance.
Thanks.
So in this day and age, there are many people who have had the experience of recognizing a dream. And so please, if you've had this experience, raise your hand. How many people have ever dreamt and knew that they were dreaming?
Yeah.
So there are many. So then you know what the experience is like to have dreamed and recognized that you were dreaming. So some people, when they dream and they know they're dreaming, fly in the sky and dance in the sky. So how many people out of those of you who dreamed and knew that you were dreaming did something like that? Raise your hand.
Yeah.
A lot. When you dream and you know you're dreaming, then that's a special experience. When you go from not knowing that you're dreaming to knowing you're dreaming, that transformation is a special experience. For example, Milarepa's disciple who was like the moon, Rechung Dorje Drakpa, had the experience of dreaming and knowing that he was dreaming. So he did the practices that are called emanation and transformation. And he went to the pure realm, that's called the pure realm of true joy. And there he heard many Buddhas telling their life stories. And so later after he woke up, then that made the connection for him to request Milarepa to tell his own life story. So something very good happened like that. So some people can do that. They can dream and know they're dreaming and do this practice of emanation and transformation and then go to a pure realm. That's why in the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, the practices of illusory body and dream yoga are important.
What is the basis of distinction between complete purity and perfect purity?
Namda tanyonda la kepa karedo.
Namda tanyonda la dada dacha cheke chepa hayere. Cheke chepa te da namberata.
It's just a distinction in terms of the words. It's not a distinction in terms of the meaning. So for example, with the self, then you would say the self is completely pure and therefore forms are completely pure. Forms are completely pure and therefore the self is completely pure. Thus the self completely pure and forms completely pure are not dual, cannot be made dual, are not separate, and are not different. If you wanted to find a difference, then you could say that perfect purity is emphasizing the purity down to the essence and that it's originally pure. Whereas complete purity is emphasizing the scope of the purity, that it's completely pure, including everything. But that's just emphasis. Their meaning is actually the same. And so the sutras on complete purity teach about these 12 kinds of ways of saying self, which are the self is completely pure, sentient beings are completely pure, life force is completely pure. The caregiver is completely pure. The individual is completely pure. The person is completely pure. The creator is completely pure. No, the strong one is completely pure, the leader is completely pure, the creator is completely pure, the seer is completely pure, the knower is completely pure, and... The knower is completely pure, Shepapo, creator. What's number 11, Walker? I don't want to look. Chepapo, Tongwapo. Oh, the experiencer. The experiencer is completely pure. So I'll say it one more time. The self, sentient being, life force, the caregiver, the person, the individual, the strong one, the leader, the creator, the experiencer, the knower, and the seer. These are the 12 different ways of saying self, and they're all taught to be completely pure. And one reason why we can know that is true is that since desire and anger and stupidity are all perfectly pure, then the ones who experience them have to be completely pure too. Whatever they're called, any of these 12 names.
Yes,
sir. And probably the reason why the Buddha taught these 12 kinds of complete purity is precisely that, because after you find out that desire and anger and stupidity are perfectly pure, you still might have doubt and you might wonder, well, what about me, the one who experiences these? The sentient being, for example. Then the Buddha taught that the sentient being is also completely pure, eliminating all uncertainty. In Vajrayana and Mahayana, both, it's taught that all phenomena are perfectly pure. And so if you're going to understand what that means, then you have to know that the three poisons of desire, anger, and stupidity are perfectly pure. And you have to know that the one who experiences them is also perfectly pure. That's the two main points. And when you know well how these three are perfectly pure and these 12 are completely pure, then there's nothing that possibly is left that could be impure. And then everything is the infinite expanse of purity. And then what the ultimate pure realms are and the relative pure realms are become clear. It's like that. We'll close with Milarepa's aspiration prayer that we sang last night. Now it would be good to make an aspiration prayer for all the sentient beings with whom we have both good and bad connections. All you sentient beings, I have a good or bad connection with. As soon as
Samba Samma Kimmy Jedding.
now the song of bodhisattvas and bodhisattvas being free of attachment and full of love.
Bodhisattvas and bodhisattvas are empty forms, just like a water.